Hello, everyone, and welcome to the third Boat Briefing podcast. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and I'm joined today by Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Charlotte, how are you coping with this heat?
Absolutely melting, Stuart, and I've had to turn the fan off for the recording, so it's going to be one of the quicker podcasts we've done, I reckon.
So for everyone listening who isn't in the UK at the moment, it's about a million degrees outside. So when the UK, when it gets over 30 degrees Celsius in the UK, it genuinely feels like you're walking on the sun, and it's quite unpleasant sometimes. So everyone is just hiding inside and in any shade they can find. But enough about that. Today we'll be talking you through the latest headlines from the world of superyachts, and we'll also hear from Nina Jensen, the CEO of Rev Ocean. So Rev Ocean, in case you didn't know, is a 183 600-foot superyacht cum research vessel currently under construction in Norway. When delivered, it will become not only the longest superyacht in the world, eclipsing 180-meter Azam, but also the biggest in terms of gross tonnage, taking the number one spot from Dilbar. How did the interview go, Charlotte?
It was fantastic. You know, she's such an interesting lady. I don't want to spoil it too much because obviously it's on this episode later. But such an inspirational woman and really a true scientist at heart. She had to be persuaded into the project. Apparently, the businessman that set it up called her every day for a year before she agreed to do the job. So wow. She's sticking to her principles, and I think that's admirable. And I think she's the perfect woman to take the project on and hopefully do some really great things and inspire everyone else to do some really great things too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should probably use this opportunity to plug the magazine a little bit. So the next issue is the September issue, and that is out on Thursday, this coming Thursday, whatever that is, when this podcast comes out. So that features a behind-the-scenes look at the construction of Rev, and it's a fascinating insight into this monstrous vessel. So press releases have started arriving in our inboxes at a furious rate, and that means only one thing. It's boat show season. Well, of sorts, given everything that's going on. In just under a month, the Cannes Yachting Festival will kick off, and I have to pinch myself a little bit. I can't quite believe it's happening. There will be around 340 motor yachts on display and 80 sailing yachts, and I've had a look through to pick out some of my highlights. So Sunreef will be at the show with their 80 motor catamaran and 80 sailing catamaran. And I mentioned that because obviously in the first podcast, we had an interview with Rafael Nadal, who recently picked up the keys to his Sunreef 80 motor catamaran. It was actually at the Cannes Yachting Festival a few years ago where he first got introduced to the company and decided that a catamaran was the way to go. I'm also really looking forward to seeing the first 40-meter Benetti Oasis. This will be the world debut for the boat. It's a really exciting project because it's designed by RWD, which is obviously a hugely successful and established superyacht studio. But the interior was done by a New York firm that had never done a boat before called Benetti Kazursky.
Well, I'm super excited for that one too, Stu, because we met Benetti Kazursky, Enrico and Dominic are their first names, at the Superyacht Design Festival in Cortina last year. And I really think they're one of those kind of yachting talents to watch. I don't know whether they're going to want to do another yacht or if this is a one-off, but they're really sharp guys, very interested in conservation, very interested in new techniques. So they were speaking a lot at the festival about glass and the amazing new ways they've used it on this boat, which is a bit of a trend we've seen across a number of boats. But it sounds like they really pushed the boundaries with this project. And just looking at the architectural projects they've done, like the Pace Gallery in the States is one of them that's also, you know, got a huge glass front to it. It's very sleek and elegant and really quite incredible. So I think if I was going to Cannes, which I'm not, but if I was, I would definitely check that one out. And follow their work quite closely. It's their sort of debut into the yachting world, so it'd be interesting to see what comes next.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait because, a 40-meter platform is a big old boat to start off with, and then they with no yachting experience, they've kind of tried to rewrite the rule book of how people live on board their boats. So how they've interpreted that will be really interesting, I think.
And I'm kind of all for this trend in general about having loads of glass on yachts. It seems such a shame in the past when you're on your super yacht and you can barely see the ocean. So opening things up a bit, whether it's by having big beach clubs or bigger outdoor spaces on the deck or having lots of glass, I think is a really great thing. And it's a nice trend to see.
Yeah, it's all about the inside-outside experience nowadays. Another boat I'm excited to see is the first Azimut Magellano 25. I've been a bit long time fan of the Magellano series since it was, I think the first one was probably about a decade ago. And they were built as kind of like pocket explorers from Azimut, and they had a kind of a husky look. But the first 25, the new 25, has more kind of svelte lines, and they come from the board of Ken Frevok. But look, the whole concept of the Magellano is all about luxurious passage making. So that essence hasn't been lost, or at least I hope it hasn't. So I'm very keen to see that. Another talk about svelte boats, the Mangusta Grand Sport 33 is a great looking boat penned by the designer of the moment, Alberto Mancini. He's a huge car nut. So there are some automotive cues in the styling of this one. It's the first time it will be seen anywhere. There's the Okean 80. We recently tested the Okean 50 and we're really impressed by the amount of innovation they'd packed on board. It's all about folding platforms and creating this perfect kind of on-water experience. So now they've scaled it up to 80 foot. So they've pretty proper super yacht territory. So it'll be interesting to see what they've done with that. The Cannes show wouldn't be the same without a Riva debut. So it'll be the first time to see the Riva 88 Folgore. I hope I've pronounced that right. It means lightning in Italian. It's always great to see a new Riva, especially one with such a cool name. We'll actually also be featuring this model in the magazines very soon, so don't miss that. But generally, I'm just blown away by the amount of boats that the show say will be there. Like I said, 340 motor yachts and 80 sailing boats. And what's really good about Cannes, actually, is that they take sailing really seriously. At Monaco, sometimes the criticism is that the masts can be drowned out a bit by the monstrous motor yachts on display. But in Cannes, they have their whole separate part of the show to themselves. So the sailing fanatics really have something to go and see. But yeah, I'm just thrilled the show's happening at all, really. Obviously, face masks will be mandatory and there'll be controlled crowd flows and hand sanitizer pumps everywhere you turn. In brokerage news, one of the biggest deals of the year was completed last week. The 73-meter Fed ship Hasna was sold, with Burgess repping the seller and Wyco the buyer.
We did an event on that, didn't we, Stu, last year, an owners club thing?
That's right, yeah. The boat was on the east coast of the States, and the owners kindly let us pile on board for a bit of a party one evening.
Very brave.
It was my first. Yeah, very brave. it was my first opportunity to see the boat as well. And it's a beautiful boat. Look, again, it's an RWD design. They do great work inside and out. Really, really special boat. And actually, it's also being featured in the US edition of the magazine very, very shortly, because despite being launched back in 2016 or 2017, I think it was, this is the first opportunity we've had to actually get on board the boat, because they used it so much, as they should. You know, they did something like 40,000 nautical miles in its first couple of years. They went to Bora Bora, the Caribbean. They went all over the Med, obviously, and in the east coast of the US, which is where we caught up with them. But lovely couple, lovely boat. But now they're boatless, so I wonder what's going to come next for those guys. In launch news, the new Spirit 111 Geist has hit the water. Well, it hit the water a while ago, but it's now been completed. And Charlotte, I believe you've fallen a bit in love with this one.
I have a bit. I mean, I love sailing boats anyway. I think that's where my heart really lies. And like everybody else, I love the kind of classic J-class yachts and seeing them out on the water. But I love the interior of this one. It's quite unusual. It's super curvy. So everything is sort of very rounded and soft. The beds in the cabins are almost like little round pods. The shower is almost like a kind of little tube almost. And it's all, not really doing it justice in the description, but it's all done in wood as well. So it's really sleek and modern looking and quite sexy. And it just looks a bit different to other things. We're used to kind of seeing the whole natural wood and natural textiles, but it can look kind of much of a muchness. But this is quite different, and it looks really elegant and beautiful. And it's beautiful on the outside as well.
Yeah, I think you did. You described it very well. It's absolutely right. It's a stunning boat.
And it's nice to see something coming out of Suffolk as well. I went to school around there. It's nice to see something coming out of my homeland. And it's very lovely.
It's not often you look at marine traffic and see a superyacht's AIS signature popping up in Ipswich. So yeah, it's very good. Very good to see. So again, another gratuitous plug. That is also being featured in the magazine very shortly, the Spirit 111. We spoke to the owner, and he was obviously very focused on green issues. He said, a Tesla of the seas. So there's some really impressive tech packed on. So it's kind of this marriage of old world wooden craftsmanship and new world electric technology. Can't wait to see that. Actually, Spirit Yachts is in a bit of a purple patch at the moment. So Bill Duca, who is the former owner of the 70-metre Perini sailing yacht Sybaris, wants to build the world's biggest wooden sloop at Spirit Yachts. They're not quite at contract stage yet, but he told me he was desperate to build it with Spirit Yachts. And on the evidence of the Spirit 111, I think they'll do a sensational job with it. So in some not-so-great news, I caught up with another owner a couple of days ago, Fiddy Angermeyer, who owns a couple of big yachts out in the Galapagos. That's where he's based. Actually, that's where he's from. He's a native of the islands. Lovely guy, but he was bizarrely quarantined on his yacht for over 100 days, stuck in Panamanian waters, and he couldn't check into Ecuador and therefore get to the Galapagos. It's a wild story, actually. He told us all about it. That'll be in the October issue of the magazine too.
It's a bit like that film with what's that film with Tom Hanks where he gets trapped at an airport for ages? The Terminal. It's like the super yacht version of The Terminal, trapped between two places and nowhere to go.
I suppose of the two, I'd rather be stuck on a super yacht than in an airport terminal. But still,
definitely.
It probably got a bit tedious because they couldn't actually go anywhere. They said when they all supplies, provisions had to be delivered by taxi, and then obviously when they got it on board, everything had to be sterilised with wipes, and I imagine it was all very tedious. But he did eventually make it to the Galapagos, and the whole point of this is the fact that when he turned up, he said it was the situation there is not great. The Galapagos, as we all know, the entire economy is tourism-based, and since there has been no tourism, it's in a pretty bad way. And he's genuinely concerned about the future of the islands and the pristine marine environment that surrounds them.
But it's not just tourism, is it, Stu? Because aren't there lots of Chinese fishing vessels out there, and that's causing problems as well?
Yeah, so there's been a flurry of headlines lately. And if you look at marine traffic and go look at the Galapagos Islands, there's a few kind of smattering of boats here and there. But then if you look a bit south of the islands, there's this vast clump of what are Chinese fishing vessels just kind of waiting in a kind of a sinister fashion just outside the island's territorial waters, which obviously isn't great. So that's adding to the tension of things. So, we're looking into this. We'll be doing a feature, an upcoming issue about the health of the islands, the economy of the islands, and what can be done by yacht owners. But I think the obvious answer is if you have the opportunity to go there, the best time to visit is between December and May. So if you are wondering, what are we going to do with our boat this winter season? Why not go to the Galapagos and help out this struggling place and make sure it stays as special as it is?
If you do head down, I think there is one super yacht. I saw one very brave lone yacht heading over there this morning. I think it was G2, which is a very beautiful boat. So they're leading the charge, as they should, and hopefully other people will follow them.
Yeah, absolutely. Following G2's wake. G2, obviously, a World Super Yacht Award-winning refit done at Pendennis. Stunning boat, actually. So they, again, we were talking to the guys on board that boat, and they said they were expecting to see very, very few other boats in the Galapagos. They're going to have the whole place to themselves, but I'm sure they'll be given a royal welcome when they arrive. Of course, G2 shouldn't be alone. There should have been dozens of super yachts visiting the Galapagos this year, because obviously everyone was very excited about making that Pacific crossing down to New Zealand for the America's Cup, but so many plans were cancelled. So instead of a bumper year, the Galapagos were expecting, genuinely dozens of boats to show up and, dump money into the local economy. Now there's a solitary super yacht on its way, but it's a real shame that that's not happening. And obviously that's had knock-on effects for the America's Cup, because there's the super yacht regatta down there, which is still, we spoke to the organisers the other day, and they're still expecting really good numbers, but it's not going to be the massive fleet they're expecting. But it should still be a really good event, and I can't wait to head down there and check that out for myself.
Yeah, it is such a shame. I interviewed a whole load of owners that were heading down for the America's Cup earlier this year, and like their itineraries sounded amazing. I had serious envy hearing about all the kind of remote islands they were going to, places like the Tuamotus and things like that, and seeing all the photography of these absolutely pristine remote places. They were just the most incredible journey. So I hope that some of those people are still heading out there, albeit in a slightly modified way. But New Zealand's doing very well on the COVID front anyway, in terms of number of cases and the spread of infections and things. From my understanding, it's pretty much life as normal over there.
Yeah, well, you look at pictures. I think they're 100 days as of recording. They're 100 days COVID-free or something like that. But anyway, you look at pictures, bars and cafes and restaurants full, no distancing requirements. I mean, it is basically life is back to normal. So as an example to follow, let's all do what New Zealand did and get back to normal as soon as possible. So it'll be interesting to see actually how they cope with the America's Cup, because that will involve, you know, thousands and thousands of people from all over the world flying in to New Zealand. So I'm sure that's at the top of their minds right now. But fingers crossed the America's Cup itself won't be affected.
And the sailing for the MasterCard Regatta, that's at the Haruki Gulf, right? That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's an amazing place to sail. Yeah, it really is special. And all of New Zealand, I mean, what a place to go cruising. So I was up at the top of the North Island a few years ago at the Millennium Cup, which we are a partner of. Oh, my, what a place. I don't think I've been to a more beautiful sailing location in my entire life. Just tons of islands, completely pristine, water crystal clear, warm. Beautiful place to sail. So it's a great shame that all those owners that were going to cross the Pacific aren't going to see it. But hopefully, you know, plans are plans. They can just be postponed for a year and everyone can head across the Pacific next year. Sadly, there won't be an America's Cup waiting for them. But you'll still have all of New Zealand, which is a pretty good prize at the end of that.
I also think that the Kiwis really understand and love boats. When I was speaking to Aaron from the Yacht Club last year, he was kind of saying, you know, they do sailing like we've done PE or like sports in the state. You know, they've been out on little dinghies since they were tiny. So there's a real passion, not just from people kind of attending the cup, but just all the local population and the country, really. They just love it. So it will be an incredible atmosphere, however many people go, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. They punch way above their weight in so many things, the Kiwis. I mean, they're amazing sailors, holders of the America's Cup, after absolutely smashing the States last time round in Bermuda. And of course, you know, they're a great sporting tradition like the All Blacks. You know, a population of 4 or 5 billion people can produce such amazing sports people. It's pretty incredible. Right, I believe, Charlotte, we have some crew salary news. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's always exciting to talk statistics. I'm not going to get bogged down in the numbers, but essentially we do a salary survey on our sister publication, DocWalk. I'm sure lots of people will be familiar with it. It's for captains and crew specifically. So every year we reach out to individual crew members and ask them to fill out the survey, as well as various crew agencies that give us their point of view. And sometimes it's very positive and sometimes it's not. This year, I think, wouldn't surprise anyone in that everybody's been affected by corona. People were saying they've had salary cuts, they've had an admin nightmare, they've been on the kind of front line of looking after the yachts for the owners and have had a lot to deal with. But also people are sticking on boats a lot longer. People are less likely to move and there are less positions available. So if someone is desperate to move, they're likely to take a salary cut or to take a salary beneath their pay grade to make the move. So it's causing quite a static market. And it's also seeing that a significant drop in rotation, which is a real shame. When we did our survey last year, one of the things that all the crew and owners were saying is a great perk that everyone wants is more rotation. It stops people getting burnt out. It gives me a bit more stability. It gives them the ability to kind of have more stable relationships and things with their families. But that's come down as a result of this, which is a shame. And it's also the end of the dock walk, which I think is rather sad. You know, that you often hear these quite romantic stories from captains about how they began their careers. And it always begins with kind of walking down a promenade in Monaco and seeing the bright lights of a super yacht up ahead and handing in a CV to someone on the back of a boat. And that's just not happening now. They're going to have to log on like everyone else and, you know, join the thousands of other CVs from people all over the world, which is a bit of a shame, I think. There's something about meeting people in person and going up to people in person, which gives you a better sense of them than an email. But there's a bit of a silver lining, which is that there is a sense that if owners are spending more time on board, which we hear from many of you, you are, people are prepared to potentially pay more than their normal spend to get better crew for the duration. So I think that's a great idea. We've discussed it before, Stuart, but I think, you know, having a great crew, it's not just about having a good service on board. It's about, you know, reducing the wear and tear on your boat. People who know what they're doing are much more likely to pick up problems earlier on. People who can really add to the experience and guide you and get you to do things you didn't even know you wanted to do because they're just that bit more experienced and the right people for the job.
Yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science for me, is it? I mean, it's good crew. Crew can make or break the super yacht experience for an owner. I've spoken to people who have had bad experiences with their first boat and particular crew, and so they've kind of left the industry. But I've spoken, you know, owners with a good crew hold on to them for dear life because they make all the difference. I mean, they're the ones on board the boat 24/7, so they know it better than anyone else, and it's really worth getting the best possible people on your boat as you can. But I love the fact that you really romanticise the idea of the dock walk then.
I know it's a fair amount of trudging up and down in the heat as well. I've not done a dock walk, so it's fine for me to look back and say how lovely it is when I'm not the person doing it. But I just think, you know, we know here at Boat, you know, if we have any job advertised, you get hundreds of CVs and it's really hard to differentiate them. And actually, I think what I've heard from owners about their captains and their crew is that when it really works, it's a personality match. It's someone who, you know, you see eye to eye with, they're on the same wavelength, whether it's, you know, you're super adventurous and your captain has the same kind of thirst for pushing the boundaries, or whether you just want a quiet time in the Caribbean and your stews are quite chilled out and they want the same thing. But it's like dating, essentially. You're trying to find people you really click with, and that's not really going to work on email in the same way.
No, it's certainly true. Certainly true. So all the results of that salary survey will be in an upcoming issue of Dock Walk. And we've also stolen a bit for Boat International. So keep an eye out for that. It's quite an insight into what's happening with salaries on board. So we've had some lovely feedback from the podcast for the podcast so far. So please keep it coming. If you'd like us to discuss any particular topics, just drop us an email at podcast@boatinternationalmedia.com and let us know if there's a burning issue. In fact, it gave us an idea for something. It's about a kind of an open forum for super yacht questions. If there's a burning question you've always wanted to know about super yachting, why do boats get designed a certain way? What is dynamic positioning? How do stabilizers work? It could be anything. If you have a question about the super yacht industry that you would like answered, please drop us an email and we will get an expert from the business to answer it. It could be quite a nice way to, it can all be perfectly anonymous. We have to say that if it's a really stupid question, there are no stupid questions, let's leave it at that. You can ask anything. So drop us a line, podcast@boatinternationalmedia.com. And we'll get the answer to you.
We had, following last week, we had Guillermo from DKT Artwork. Some people will know him in the industry. He wrote in to point out that after we were chatting about Succession last week, they actually spotted one of their own artworks on board Solange, and he sent us the clip. And you can see Tom from Succession arguing and striding past a very beautiful panel which belongs to them. So, yeah, it's always great to hear from people about what they've thought about what we've said, and adding on to it is really interesting to hear too.
And he didn't let go any spoilers in the email, which was also good because I'm still catching up with it.
What are you doing, Stuart? Why haven't you seen it yet? We're in lockdown. It's the perfect time.
Too many children, too much work. That's generally the problem. Alrighty, that's about it from the headlines this week. Stay tuned because in a minute you'll hear from Nina Jensen, who sat down with Charlotte for an interview about Rev Ocean. Thanks, everybody. Here's the interview.
Hello, everyone. Well, Rev Ocean is a yacht that we've talked about a lot over the past couple of weeks. In fact, to call her a yacht isn't really true, because this 90-person research vessel come super yacht is really in a class of her own. You can read all about the making of this incredible boat in our September issue, And today we are honoured to have with us Nini Jensen, the CEO of RevOcean and the woman tasked with overseeing its future. Nina, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Where are you at the moment? Are you in Norway at present?
I'm in sunny Oslo at the moment, yes.
Lovely. So for those who don't know, RevOcean is the brainchild of a Norwegian businessman, Kjell Inge Røkke. Hope I'm saying that right. My Norwegian accent is probably not the best. I'm doing fine. And you're the CEO, so you're the woman in charge of putting her to work. So I was curious to kind of start at the beginning. How did you first meet Kjell? How did the whole connection with them begin?
Well, I met him when I was working for WWF, World Wildlife Fund, and we started a cooperation many, many years ago to firstly improve fishing operations in one of his earlier companies, Aker Seafoods, and then as they were starting up Aker Biomarine, a company operating krill fishing in the Southern Ocean. We partnered with them on that as well to make sure that it was fully sustainable from the onset of the operations.
Right, so you had kind of known them for a while. And when did the sort of RevOcean project hone into view? Was it something that you'd always discussed doing, or was it something he kind of came to you with and approached you with?
Yeah, this was definitely an idea that he had been brewing on for many, many years. And he approached me in 2017 to start discussing the idea and what he was thinking. And then I helped him sort of shape the initiative and develop the thinking further from where it originally started. And well, here we are today.
And did you always believe it was going to happen? Was it one of those things that felt a bit kind of pie in the sky, but yeah, is it really going to get built? Or did it always seem quite serious?
Well, you know, at the beginning, I was quite skeptical. From the very beginning, he asked me if I wanted to come work for him and run the initiative. And I instantly said no. Even though I loved the initiative and I wanted to help him develop it, I really, really loved my job in WWF. And I didn't think there was a better place to make a difference in the world than in that organization. And I was also not sure that he actually was serious about really changing the fate of the ocean. So he called me pretty much every single day for a full year to convince me to take the job. And well, he can be quite persistent, and he's used to fixing unsolvable problems and getting what he wants. And, you know, at the end of the day, I just figured this is probably the best fighting chance we have of making a real difference for the ocean at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I wonder, did you have, you know, as well as what you're saying about making a difference, it's a project that comes with a certain amount of pressure attached to it, because obviously, you know, all these amazing scientists want to get on board and you have the potential to do some really great stuff with it. Do you think of it in that terms? Did it seem a bit daunting, or do you just view it as an amazing scientific opportunity?
What seems daunting is the environmental problems of the ocean, which are completely overwhelming. I mean, only in our lifetime, over the past 40 years, we've lost more than 40% of life in the ocean. And it is accelerating as a result of overfishing, climate change, and plastic pollution. So that's what seems most daunting. It's thrilling to be able to start up this initiative and work with some of the best and brightest minds from all over the world to come up with the solutions.
And are lots of those people former colleagues? Is it almost like a team that you've picked, or is it new people and you've all been united by the cause?
More the latter, actually. So these will be people from various backgrounds with the varied knowledge, skill sets, and representing very different institutions from all over the world. So I probably won't know half of them even. Yeah. So we'll be working with both scientific institutions, but also with technology companies, with ocean enthusiasts, with NGOs, with philanthropists, anyone that really wants to make a difference for the ocean, that has a great idea that should be tested out, or a scientific project that needs to be undertaken.
It's such an incredible project and such an incredible job to be sort of overseeing that. But in terms of the actual build of the boat, because obviously you're doing things that haven't been done before in terms of the actual vessel, and the project's been going for a few years now, and obviously very exciting that it's nearly nearly coming to the time where you can really put her to work. Mm-hmm. What's been the hardest part of the journey so far? Has there been a moment where you've felt a bit despairing or anything like that?
I think it's mostly our impatience in getting going. It's a very complex ship. And as you say, nothing like this has ever been built before. In many ways, it's like four ships in one. It's the most advanced scientific vessel in the world. It's the largest yacht. It's an expedition vessel. And it also has very advanced trawling capabilities to take deep water samples. So I think maybe we underestimated the complexity of building such a ship. So yeah. Dealing with the impatience and of course the urgency of getting the solutions going is probably the hardest part.
I think every yacht owner has that when you're desperate to get on something and play with it and you can't. And are there any moments where you've been particularly proud of what you've achieved so far? Because I don't know if you see it the same way as me. I even see getting the thing up and running as an incredible achievement. But does it feel like that to you?
Not really. I mean, as a marine biologist and ocean enthusiast, at the end of the day, what really matters is seeing more fish in the ocean, restored habitats, healthier coral reefs. It's those kind of thing that that will really make a difference. So at this point, we are, of course, far away from that, hence the impatience. But we'll get there. And seeing it coming together, understanding what amazing things we can do with this vessel, and also seeing the great interest from all over the world for being part of this is truly breathtaking.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things I was going to ask, actually, because you say, you know, anyone who has an idea that wants to put it into practice can be part of this incredible project. But obviously, you are limited on board to how many people you can take on and who you can take on first. How on earth do you go about filtering people? I know that there's a process, but it must be a hard job.
Yeah, that will probably be one of the hardest things to do. But we have very specific criteria for selecting projects. As an example, it has to be solutions oriented. You have to be willing to openly share your data. It has to be cross collaborative, so that you're cooperating with other scientists or ocean experts from other institutions representing other parts of the world, just as a few examples. So diversity of opinion, background, geography is really, really important to us. And we think that by bringing together people with very different thinking and background, we can maybe come to the solutions much quicker than by just putting like-minded people together at the same time. And we will have an independent scientific committee that will go through the projects to make sure that they hold the utmost scientific standard, and also that the projects are targeted towards our priority areas, which are overfishing, climate change, and plastics. So that will help us sort through a lot of it, but we will still have far more proposals and great projects than we can take on to begin with. So we'll be operating for many, many years, and hopefully in that time period, we'll be able to invite everyone on board.
And is there a hope that this is Rev 1 of many, and that if it goes incredibly well in the first year, you'll then be building more boats and having more people on board? Or is that a bit of a stretch given it's such a huge project?
I think that's probably a bit of a stretch, and certainly not in the cards at this point in time. What I'm hoping more so is that this will lead to an increasing interest and understanding of the problems that the ocean is facing, but also the endless opportunities that lie there if we treat her well, and focusing more on piloting specific technologies and solutions that can make a difference, and then scaling it and focusing more on that rather than having multiple vessels.
Absolutely, makes a lot of sense. And how do you feel, I'm interested, what has the response been from your side of things from within the Superyacht community? Has it been very supportive, or has it felt difficult at times and like you're a bit of an outsider? How have you felt about it?
No, I've only received very positive feedback, made a lot of interesting new contacts, established collaboration with a multitude of different, both individuals and organizations, and exploring further who we can work with to really make a difference. So it's been really welcoming, I would say, and also a lot of interest in terms of specific things that we're doing with the vessel that maybe they could be learning from, and we are of course also reaching out to others to learn from their experiences what's worked well, what hasn't worked so well, so that we don't necessarily make the same mistakes over again.
Oh, it's great to hear that collaboration is going on. I'm sort of interested, everyone in the superyacht industry, or a lot of people, say that they're kind of making strides to make greener yachts and to push their owners into building greener yachts and that sort of thing. Who do you view as the good guys? Who do you look at and you think, yeah, they are actually doing what they say and making good progress in terms of ocean-friendly boats?
So I don't know if I want to really single out anyone in particular, but sure. We have an exciting partnership with the Monaco Foundation, and they've obviously done a lot of work in terms of eco-friendly and greener yachting. And we do see a lot of interest from several philanthropists that are engaging in similar initiatives like ours. The Schmidt Ocean Institute and OceanX are just two brilliant examples of philanthropists that are doing really great things for the ocean. I also want to highlight the Water Revolution Foundation and their assessment tool. I would say that they are very dynamic and really leading the charge within the superyacht industry. So these are the kind of organizations that we're very keen to form some kind of partnership with.
That's great to know. Well, the Water Revolution Foundation, we know them well, and yes, they're definitely doing incredible things for in terms of helping yacht owners understand what they can do better and how they can do it. What would your advice be to yacht owners that kind of want to be more ocean friendly, but they're not really sure where to start?
Well, partner up with an environmental organization, for example, that could really help you out. There are a lot of things that you can do on board your own yacht, both in terms of energy use, water consumption, waste management, and of course, reducing your consumption in a lot of ways so that resources don't go to waste. Engaging with local communities in the areas that you are, supporting local projects, conservation projects. And of course, if you have the capacity, offer up your ship for scientific purposes, or invite scientists on board so that they can undertake scientific activities in certain parts of the world. Because, you know, even though we know quite a lot about the ocean, it's estimated that still only about 5% has been explored and documented. So there's a whole ocean out there waiting to be explored and understood. So then we really need everyone to engage to do that.
That's something I'd like to see a lot more of as well. We actually have a program at Boat called Yachts for Science, but there are various other initiatives. I think it's Sea Keepers in the States. There are lots of different organizations. And I think it's a bit of a no-brainer. If you're an owner with a spare cabin, why not have someone on board that can really make use of where you're going and do some incredible work there? It's quite often less complicated than people think to do. And yeah, it would be good to see a lot more of that. But on board Rev, the charter guests, because that's an unusual thing about Rev, is that there will be some charter guests. They actually get to take part in the science, don't they? What sort of things can they do?
Well, they don't have to. Obviously, we'll
you're not going to march them to the laboratory.
No, but that is one of the really unique opportunities of this vessel, given that we have the most advanced scientific equipment in the world. So you would get the opportunity to explore previously undiscovered places and species and ocean features using very sophisticated equipment such as sonars, ROVs, and a deep diving submersible that can take you down to 2,300 meters in depth. This means that it will be possible to locate wrecks, hydrothermal vents, and, you know, discover new species that can even be named after you if you wanted to.
I was going to ask, as a former scientist yourself, being honest, how do you really feel about the general public kind of getting involved in this sort of thing? Does it make you a bit nervous? Do you feel like there's a sort of boundary between scientists and people that don't really know what they're doing? Or do you really welcome it and think this is the future of funding research?
I actually welcome it, and I think, you know, if we are to solve the problems of the ocean, we really need everyone to engage. There's so much that we don't know about the ocean, so getting support and help in gathering the relevant pieces of data is really, really important. But of course, there are limits in terms of what the general public can do. So you really need the scientists to do all the analysis, the quality proofing of the data, making sure that you're comparing apples to apples and not mixing up things and so forth. And of course, doing the scientific sampling in a proper way so that it's not damaging the marine environment and that you're actually sampling what you want to be looking at. But I think both in terms of data collection, but also in terms of increased engagement and understanding of the ocean and the desire and willingness to create the solutions, I think that really stems from curiosity, engagement and data collection and just being out there.
Definitely. And I know this is changing day by day and COVID-19 has not exactly helped anyone. Do you know, when do you think you're going to be setting off on your first voyage?
I'm still hesitant to give a final date because we have been unfortunately delayed as a result of COVID-19 and a very complex build process. But we are hopeful that we will be ready in 2022, and then we will embark on our first mission, which will be a pole-to-pole mission, going first up to the Arctic and then making our way down to the Antarctic.
God, how exciting. And I take it, will you be on board for the first mission?
Absolutely. I don't know for how long and for how much of the journey. And of course, the most important thing is to spend the vessel time well and get the most qualified people on board. So I'm happy to give up my spot if it can make a difference for the ocean at the end of the day.
Well, that's very noble of you. And will you have charter guests on the first voyage, or will that come later down the line?
No, we will definitely have charter guests on multiple parts of our first year. But given that we don't know the specific dates, it's been really hard to plan for anything in detail. Obviously, we know some of the key locations that we want to visit, but not firming up things just yet.
Well, a trip on board this incredible vessel, pole to pole, in 2022. I'm sure lots of people will be writing this in their diaries now and watching your page very closely. Thank you so much for talking to us, Nina. It's been lovely to speak to you, and what an exciting project.
It was such a pleasure, and I really hope that the interest continues to increase, and welcome everyone to join our mission in saving the ocean.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Nina.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Boat Briefing. We put out a new podcast every week on Spotify or iTunes, so look us up and like and subscribe. See you next week.